It's the looks, it's the gasps, it's the, excuse me, sir, you're in the women's toilet. And if that happens to the Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, you know, and I can't say the things I used to say when I wasn't the Commissioner.
What would you say, Ro?
I can't say that on radio, mate.
I'm Ben Nielsen, and this is LGBTI Q&A, conversations with leaders who happen to be queer. Rowena Allen is Victoria's first Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, and I actually don't think anyone is better suited to do the job. Rose worked in social justice for most of their adult life and has also been involved in a number of government LGBT initiatives. But it's not just Rose's professional experience that qualifies them for the job, it's also their own personal experiences. Ro identifies as a walker, a Native American term which is pretty similar to the term gender fluid.
I suppose in different times of my life I've identified as a butch lesbian. You know, there's all different range of things. I'm remembering when I was 5, I asked my parents for a sex change operation. So, okay. You know, there's been gender dysphoria is something that I've lived with all my life. And so I'm probably at a very comfortable stage now at 45 to be able to say I'm gender diverse and that's okay.
So while your parents had sort of experienced your confusion with your identity from quite a young age, why was it that your father had a heart attack when you finally came out with him?
You know, I think Dad just didn't want me to have a hard life. I think that's what parents think. And I think the shock was really hard for him. He had an underlying heart condition. So I do make jest of it now when I tell the story, but it wasn't funny at the time. But, you know, he survived and went on for another, you know, 25, 30 years. So, you know, by the time my sister came out, he's like, oh, well, whatever. You know, he was just completely okay with it. And I think it's a good story because it, you know, reminds people that people can move. You know, he moved from physically having a heart attack when he found out his daughter was a lesbian to, you know, taking both his lesbian daughters on, you know, on a holiday in a minivan with their partners through Vegas.
That's like, so lovely.
You know, like he moved and I think it's good to tell that story because it shows people wherever people are, you know, people are moving towards acceptance. They're not moving back into unacceptance.
And do you see that with public figures as well?
Oh, absolutely. Look at James Molino, you know. I remember when James Molino was the Minister for Youth and he struggled to say LGBTI or same-sex attracted when I was the Chair of the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria. And, you know, and then since then he's had his own children and he's thought about what he would say and do if one of those children came out to him as part of the LGBTI community. And, you know, he's a genuine guy. And you know, he's gone out in The Age saying he's supporting marriage equality. So, you know, Jeff Kennett, the same. You know, he moved enormously, you know, from almost getting, a lawsuit against him for what he said about gay people, gay men particularly, and, you know, now being a big supporter for Beyond Blue's LGBTI depression stream of resources and information. So I think when you get people past the fear, and that's what homophobia or phobia or any type, biphobia or transphobia is about, it's about the fear. And when they can overcome their fear, they see that, you know, it's really irrational. Phobias are irrational fears. That we are simple people of, you know, just like everybody else, getting on with our lives, and there's nothing to be scared of.
You're part of a rainbow family, so you are getting on with your life in terms of having kids and that sort of very normal lifestyle. How did that go down with the people around you?
Well, we lived in country town at the time when I got pregnant with Alex, and so it was always going to be the village that raises kids. So it was never a problem in our intimate circle. At the hospital was a little different. We were the first lesbian couple to have a child, and in country Victoria, the local paper comes around and takes pictures of, you know, the parents and the kid and the baby, and they came to our room and they didn't take a picture. And I was so sick post-pregnancy, I couldn't have given a rat's, but my partner found that fairly homophobic. But they came back the next day to say, we're really sorry we didn't take a picture. We wanted to go back to our editor and see whether we could do a feature story. So after that feature story in the Shepparton News, we did get some hate mail. And that hate mail was very vicious. It was in a congratulations on the birth of your child card, and you open it up and it was cut out. You know, stick down. Like, who would be bothered to spend that much time cutting letters out and sending that sort of horrific stuff? So that was pretty bad. But, you know, one piece of hate mail compared to the amount of affirmation and support we got. And number of LGBTI families have moved into Violet Town. We joke now that we're not the only gays in the village anymore, you know. And
so Violet is really rainbow now.
Rainbow, you know. Hoping that it would send the prices to the same level as Daylesford, but it hasn't actually done that yet.
And so how does your daughter cope with that, and also the children from Kay's former relationship?
The two older boys are fabulous. It's just like a complete non-issue. And that's the age and generation and the way those kids have been brought up. So it's a complete non-issue. They love their sister, just like big brothers. So that's never been a problem there. They're absolutely fantastic. Alex just gets on with it. She knows no different. She knows a lot of other rainbow family kids. Being part of my family and the job that I'm doing, she has to, you know, come along to all sorts of barbecues, and she goes to, you know, transgender kids' barbecues and mixes with them and mixes with rainbow families, and, you know, she's in a very supportive place, which is great.
Tell me about religion and its place in your life.
Well, I grew up in the Uniting Church, and a lot of my career advancements and the skills that I've developed are because of that. So I was very early indoctrinated in social justice principles and understandings, and so that drives who I am. So I was very much involved in the Uniting Church's prison task force, and, you know, we had apartheid back then, so the South African support group and all those different groups. So when I came out, I was just the new social justice issue for my group of friends, you know, and so that was a really supportive place to do that. But also the overlay of that was it wasn't always supportive. And I candidated for ministry and needed to come out in that process. And that was kind of horrific if I look back on having a group of, you know, the presbytery group, like a regional church council, voting on whether I was, you know, success, you know, had the gifts and graces or should be allowed through. And, you know, I got voted through 64 to 35 or whatever it was as a majority. But, you know, you still know there's 35 people there and the only reason they had was my sexuality, you know. It's tricky. So, you know, I was a youth representative representing the National Council of Churches overseas and did some international work, and that gave me a global perspective, which I've always found and drawn on for all my multicultural work in the space. So I've got a lot to thank the religious institutions for, but now I consider myself more a spiritual than religious person.
Did you thank them when people were trying to exorcise you?
Well, I got to say, that wasn't the Uniting Church. It was a small period of my life where I slipped off into an Assembly of God church for a little while because the music was a bit more funky. And, you know, that was probably the most horrific experience of my life. Uh-huh. But again, thanks to, you know, Reverend Dorothy McRae McMahon and some of the elders that I had in the Uniting Church, they rescued me, literally rescued me from that. And
how
the belief,
did they rescue you?
Well, they literally said, it's not a choice between your sexuality and spirituality, and showed me a different path. Unfortunately for many people, where that's not reconcilable, or they're not bisexual, and so they have, you know, possible choices of a life-giving love, you know, many people take their lives. And, you know, I was fortunately not one of those. But in this role, I'm obviously working with the survivors now of gay conversion therapy, and it's alive and well in Victoria, and, you know, I'm doing everything I can to make sure people know about that.
Many have walked away from their faith. Is there something that made you stay?
I don't know if there's something or someone. You know, there's been a number of role models, as I've said, that have shown me that it doesn't have to be a choice. And there look a number of, you know, I get to work with Australia's first openly out gay imam. It's not just a Christian religion. You know, he says, Commissioner, I'm the only out gay imam. I'm not the only gay imam. So there's a more closeted people in the church than, you know. I mean, historically, that was the vocation for gay men. They didn't marry. They became, you know, they became priests and nuns. There's great stories of lesbian nuns. Mm. So there's a lot of LGBTI people that live in the church, you know. The new Pride Centre will have a, you know, chapel and prayer space, you know. It is part of our community as well. And I can also recognise the people that have been so hurt by those institutions than the complete atheists and church and religious haters. And we've got to make room for all. You know, it has to be about love and acceptance. And for me, yeah, what I've learnt from my church experience is the acceptance of others and the acceptance of difference. And I think that's
the strong morals.
Yeah, the strong morals. you know, that can always be tested too, you know. You know, because the, you know, the church can be quite hypocritical around what morals it picks and chooses. But I think, you know, it's about looking at it from what your own moral compass says. It, you know, that's what's really important.
Whenever I've dropped the name Rowena Allen into conversation, I've heard Ro described as warm and friendly with a wicked sense of humour. With a reputation like that, it's hard to imagine that Ro was ever the target of verbal and physical discrimination. But when Ro moved from Glen Waverley to Shepparton as a 20-year-old to establish Victoria's first rural support group for LGBT youths, not all the locals were welcoming.
I was physically assaulted. I had scratches on my car, I had lemons thrown on my roof, I had my fence graffitied. Yeah, pretty intense stuff, which would make most people, understandably, move away. I had options. I'm the type of person that went, no, you're not going to run me out of this town. I have every right to be here, I have every right to do this. And I stood my ground, which is really how I end up where I am today.
Was it a very rewarding experience, given all the crap?
Not at the time. You got to remember, I was the same age just about as the young people I was working with. So I was experiencing the same levels of distress and homophobia as they were. You know, the council that I worked for, Greater Shepparton at the time, said I couldn't run the group under their auspice. So I had to go out and get my champions. And that's what I say to people all the time. Don't do things in isolation. So I got the Youth Affairs Council regionally to auspice it, the Golden Valley Youth Affairs Network. And then I went further upstream. I went to the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria and I got them to start a statewide network, because I realised that there was strength in that as well. What was ever happening in Shepparton was also happening in Warrnambool, you know.
So is the stereotype accurate then? Small country or rural towns do find it hard to accept difference.
I think they're not... I don't think... Having just got back from the first half of my rural tour, I would stand my ground and say rural people are not more homophobic, biphobic, transphobic than metropolitan people. I just don't think they have the exposure that Melbourne does. I think they're good people.
Hmm.
But there's pockets of badness everywhere.
You keep quoting Mark Twain's quote, which is, there are two amazing days in your life, the day you're born and the day you realise why. Hmm. And when did you realise why?
The day I was outside One Treasury at the media announcement of my appointment, Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, it was one of those aha moments when, for me, I don't know what I'll do after this, because I've kind of met, this is my career high, my personal professional high. This is what I was meant to do. I know that right now. Hopefully there'll be another thing I'm meant to do at another point, but right now, these are the two amazing days in your life. Day you're born and the day you realise why, and this is my realisation of why. I suppose I've worked for social justice, and particularly LGBTIQ social justice, my whole life, my whole adult life, once I understood my own gender and sexuality issues. But this has certainly been, you know, a crescendo of that.
How were you picked for the job?
Well, you apply for these things and then you're just trying to push everyone else out of the way, really, and hope for the best.
And you don't take no for an answer, I've
Well,
heard.
You know, you just... I can remember my partner going, don't get excited, you're not there, it's first stage, second stage, you know, whatever. I'd already been a commissioner for the Victorian government. I'd been an employment skills commissioner, and I'd chaired or been a member of the last three Minister Advisory Committees on Gay and Lesbian Health, or LGBTI Health, for both sides of government. So I really pride myself on that I worked for the Coalition as well as working for Labor. And so I was what they call in government a trusted hand, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to be too radical. I understood government. I think that's important, you know. I think all of those things make up the reason that I'm here. But I know that there's six or seven other people in Victoria that could have easily been given this role. I'm just feel very humble every day that the Andrews government chose me.
And do you think those other possible candidates and the government itself are glad that you're in the role and proud of what you've achieved?
Well, I don't feel a lot of knives in my back. I know there's a lot of people that want to be me. I remember doing in week three, Melbourne high school gig, and this young lad, year nine, kept asking me questions, you know, how'd you get this job? How'd you get this job? How'd you get this job? And eventually I figured out he just wanted my job. He wanted to be me. And I said, do you mind if I just do it for a bit longer? He goes, yeah, I got to finish school first. So I think that's awesome that young people are looking up to this position and going, well, maybe I could be the commissioner for gender and sexuality in the future. That's fantastic. Look, Martin Foley, my direct handler, my boss, the Minister for Equality, he's very happy with what we've achieved. He knows I push really hard. I don't get everything I want, but you know, he likes the style of advocacy and he likes what I'm doing, which is fantastic. So I would hope at the end of this term, whenever I finally get the shift or the tap on the shoulder to move on or whatever happens in government, so far so good. Now you're jinxing me now, but touch wood. But you know, that they'll look back and there'll be a few things that we've achieved together as government and community that we can be really proud of in Victoria. Really proud of.
What are those things that you've achieved?
We are going to be world leaders in trans and gender diverse health. With the money that we've invested, the Victorian government's invested in trans and gender diverse health, will knock Amsterdam off the top perch as world leaders, not just Australian leaders, world leaders. I think having a Pride Centre in Melbourne that will give the home forever for many of our organisations, Midsummer, Queer Film, Joy Radio, Switchboard, Counselling. This is really important. These organisations need security to go forward and grow, not worried about, you know, can they find enough rent to keep the doors open. That Pride Centre will have a space to display the archives. We, you know, Victoria is the home of the LGBTI archives, and so that's really important for generations to understand and know what we've experienced, the discrimination that we've experienced, and to make sure that history is alive. I think that's really important for me, to make sure that we have spaces to do that. And, you know, many, many things. I can think of the sustainability grants, the Rural and Regional Roadshow, which is getting outcomes. You know, there's so many things that I'm proud of. And the systemic stuff that's happening, the law reform. You know, we haven't achieved everything, but we do have now the recognition of same-sex adoption, catching up with Tasmania and Western Australia. We have recognition of same-sex relationship, overseas relationships. You know, we have legislation that is improving the lives of Victorian LGBTI community. There's more to do. But you know, we are making big moves. And you know, my colleagues in other states just cry on my shoulder when when I tell them about my budget bids and my $2.5 million that the government has put into LGBTI family violence. I mean, this is extraordinary. The commitment that the Andrews government has made to family violence and then to recognise our communities. And we don't have a lot of evidence, but we know that family violence in LGBTI communities or intimate partner violence is tracking at about the same level as heterosexuals. Then we need to do something about that.
So how are you implementing strategies that don't become platforms for hate speech? Because we saw it with safe schools.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, my hope would be that we can keep educating people about what safe schools is, not what, you know, the Australian Christian lobby says it is, and give people the right information. And I think when you give them that information, they go, is that all it is? Is that what they're worried about? You know, it's not indoctrinating, it's not grooming, it's not any of those sort of things, you know. It's not even sex education, for goodness sake, you know. It's about showing respect and understanding difference.
You're called the Minister of Toilets.
Do you think Commissioner for Toilets. Don't elevate me to the Minister for Toilets. Goodness.
The Commissioner of Toilets. Is that your biggest issue? Is that the one that you really want to push over,
you know,
the line?
If that's my legacy piece, that's what they put on my tombstone. It's a bit tragic. But it is a big issue.
In amongst everything else,
toilets. And, you know, the hysterics that toilets put people in still horrifies me. And I'm not an advocate of men in women's toilets and women in men's toilets. I'm just an advocate to say trans and gender diverse people just need to be able to go like everybody else anywhere they can.
I saw it a lot in America when I was recently there. Only in arts organisations, you know, theatres would have use the toilet that you feel most comfortable in.
You can put signs till the cows come home. It's people's interaction with you in the bathroom.
What's your interaction
mean? Oh, goodness me. Last time I went to a women's toilet, it's the looks, it's the gasps, it's the, excuse me, sir, you're in the women's toilet. You know, you just, and if that happens to the Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, you know, and I can't say the things I used to say when I wasn't the Commissioner.
What would you say, Ro?
I can't say that on radio, mate. You know, I can't say that stuff anymore. And so you have to do advocacy in a very respectful way, or what do you say? Mm. What do you say? I mean, you know, the person isn't trying to be nasty to you, but they have such a gendered binary idea of what a woman looks like. I don't fit that image, and so therefore I'm in the wrong place. Honestly, I choose to do my advocacy publicly, not privately in bathrooms, and I don't use women's bathrooms or men's bathrooms if I can get away with it.
So these people who have said these things are probably just ill-informed, unaware, all those sorts of things. How do you go about communicating with those sorts of people in your job?
Well, I think we're doing it now. You know, we're talking about bathrooms. If you're in a bathroom, you know, the person that's in there probably knows where they are. It's a good chance they've looked at the door just like you. Just get on with it and get out. Smile at everybody.
But you're going on a roadshow and talking to people who might be allies, might identify as LGBTIQ. So what I'm asking is, how do you preach to the people who aren't converted?
All right. Well, I use humour. Mm-hmm. I think I follow the Buddha's wisdom about you get them laughing and you throw the pill of wisdom in. Mm-hmm. So I tell stories because people really feel afraid when they don't have... I've met someone. People still tell me, I haven't met a gay or lesbian person, let alone bi, trans or intersex, you know.
They probably have.
Well, of course they have. Of course they have. And then you try not to say that to them. You're trying to say, well, you know, statistically you probably have, you know, and they just tell you flat out. You know, I had this conversation. It wasn't an argument, it was a conversation. This guy is absolutely convinced that he'd never met a gay person before he met me. And I'm like, okay, well, now you have. Right? Now you have. And don't be surprised if all of a sudden you start meeting a whole lot more because you've got more openness. Your language will change. If you change your language, people will know you're safe and they'll let you know who they really are. And for that fella, I sort of tried to suggest to him that maybe his language about calling things gay hasn't been very safe for his mates to actually come out as gay to him or anyone. I'd love to catch up with him in 12 months' time and see whether he's met anybody else.
Yeah.
I suspect he will.
Do you have that catch up? Do you see how things have progressed in the communities that you go to?
Well, the model of the roadshow is that we send someone out. Daniel Whithouse goes out to a town, so in Swan Hill, for example, talks to everybody, finds out where all the hotspots are, where we need to go, designs what we need to do, the training, the work. We go up, we do that work, we break bread. That's obviously come out of my religious days. Dinner is really important. That breaking of bread, eating, community together, having a mayor and the transgender community sit down for the first time often in
those
communities. It's an equaliser. Share some food. We don't do wine, but we certainly do the food. Mm. And then the session we do before we go is, you know, where do you want to be? What could you do in 3 months? What could you do in 3 months? We've just started to come back in 3 months and follow up. So we came back to Swan Hill. What they've done in 3 months is extraordinary. They've got LGBTI diversity in their council plan. They've set up an LGBTI youth group with 14 logos of the groups that are supporting it. And they've got an LGBTI working party and they're planning an Ida Hobbit event in May. So how extraordinary from relatively nothing is that community. And all we did was give them the authorising environment and fired them up a little bit. But we haven't done anything else. We haven't resourced them. We haven't given them truckload of money or workers or anything else. All that has been generated from their own ideas and their own goodwill and their own community.
So you're not up against the red tape of these big bureaucratic organisations?
Of course we are. Of course we are. You know, I get in trouble all the time for not following protocol. And I truly try to follow protocol. But sometimes, sometimes the guidelines and the rules and stuff, they've been written by people. So you can talk to people about rewriting them, you know? I mean, we're looking at running possibly something at Government House. They've never done anything without pronouns.
Right.
You know, I don't know if you've ever been to Government House, you've received a gold embossed invitation and it says, you know, Mr. John Smith. And if someone presents and doesn't look like a John Smith, it's very hard. I've never got into Government House without showing my license because it always says Ms. Rowena Allen. And I turn up and the police officer asks for my license, right? Most 9 times out of 10. you know, when the aide says, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, would you like to enter the ballroom, you know, now? They could just as easily say, good evening, everybody. Lovely to have you at Government House. Would you like to follow the governor into the ballroom now? Now, who's going to notice?
Mm.
Nobody except the transgender, diverse and intersex community are going to notice. But it's going to be so powerful for their experience.
How much do we have to educate our own LGBTIQ community as much as the broadest
community? Oh, lordy me, heaps. And I reckon I spend at least 40% of my time in community trying to deal with community issues. The amount of lateral violence within our community is quite extraordinary, quite extraordinary. You know, even the use of the alphabet, you know, what letters we use, what we don't use, what I use, what I don't use. Somehow young people need to be a bit more understanding of elders' experience. And of course, elders need to understand that language changes and that they, you know, that they need to accept that that's the language that young people use. And we've got to find, I think my role is to try and find some kind of balance. So yes, I spend a lot of time educating in our community about our community.
This is really interesting. Do you think young, I'm going to use the term queer as
sure.
an umbrella term, young queer kids need to learn more about our history in Australia?
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, I remember a pop star got up in front of an award ceremony and said, I'm so proud to be the first gay man to win this award. But it was not true.
No.
There had been people who'd laid that pathway before him.
Mm.
So how can we, or how should we encourage young people to learn?
For me, it's about having the archives and having a way for young people to actually dip into their history. And I think it's so, so, so powerful. You know, many young queer people see gay cisgender men as privileged, and they have no understanding of what they lived through, where their friends and their lovers died in the 80s and 90s. It doesn't mean they're not privileged, but I think we have to understand
where they've come from
and have some kind of respect for your elders. I mean, I've worked in the Aboriginal community long enough to understand respect for your elders, and I will tell a group of young queer people, have respect for your elders. Scary now that they call me an elder. I'm 45. It's all relative, but I have such respect for my elders. I have such respect for my elders, and I hope that a young person will look at me and see that. They don't have to have respect for me, but I think they do need to have respect for people older than me that have been through some very hard, and still go through some very, very hard things, because they have made that path easier for them. Whether it doesn't help a 15-year-old to hear that, it doesn't help them. Well, my life still sucks. But possibly it would suck less. Possibly it could suck less because of the work that's been done by your elders.
Having said that, how are young people pushing the boundaries?
Oh, they're pushing language. They're uh-huh. pushing language, which is fantastic. I love that. They're pushing gender identity, which is great. You know, they just, as we did as young people, as, you know, as the elders did when they were young people. It's when you, you know, not that elders aren't passionate and fired up, but it's when you're exploring all that stuff. And I think it's absolutely fabulous.
This is LGBTIQ&A, conversations with leaders who happen to be queer. Subscribe to the podcast or find more conversations online.
If you search Rowena Allen online, you'll find videos of Ro speaking at Pride marches, leading group renditions of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and facilitating events with young queer leaders. Ro spends so much time in the community that their office staffers apparently tell them off for not being in the office more often. But Ro says there are simply too many causes than there are days in the week, and it's time that others joined the fight.
I think basic human rights is something that we all need to be advocating for. And my job fundamentally is to remind the broader Australian community, but particularly Victoria, because that's my jurisdiction, there is more to discrimination than just marriage equality. And once we achieve marriage equality, which we will, if we all keep working really hard, it's not the end. I think we should have a drink, have a celebrate, and then get back to work, because that helps some members of our community, but it doesn't do a lot for the issues that's still front and centre for bisexual, trans, intersex people, people of colour, Aboriginal, LGBTI people, all of those other people in our community that still have multiple levels of disadvantage. It does not solve all things for all people. It is not a panacea. It is great. We need to have it. It's embarrassing that we don't. Like, it's just got to an embarrassing level now, but it's not the end.
If we have broader equality than just marriage equality, How do governments and corporates and businesses benefit?
Well, see, corporates have got this. They've absolutely got this. If they want to have the brightest and smartest young people, they have to be inclusive. And the Gen Y and younger are just expecting it. So they are more onto this. They're pushing government in this space. And we see that federally as well. They're pushing government in this space. So government just needs to come along and realise that what we're talking about now is just basic human rights. It's nothing extraordinary. It's nothing left of centre. Providing a safe workplace for everybody, regardless of your ethnicity, your gender, your social, background, sexuality or gender, should just be standard practice. And you can't treat everybody equally because not everybody starts in the same level. You need to understand that people have individual needs and we need to meet those.
How do you interact when you cross paths with someone like Malcolm Turnbull or a high-profile person who vehemently is anti-queer, anti-gay?
Well, you find... What I do is try to find any level of engagement, anything of interest, any common thing we can talk about. I'm much more the carrot than the stick approach. When we had a forum on with multicultural, multi-faith people, I parked the things that we couldn't agree on, like marriage equality. So we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the stuff we can agree on, which is suicide, self-harm and gay conversion therapy of young people. Mm. And they wanted to come because they wanted to talk about that. And so we met in that space. And in that space, I found nothing but great conversation. When I had coffee with Dan Flynn from the Australian Christian Lobby, it was a useful conversation. I think I spoke more than he did, probably so he couldn't get too much in. But it was, again, we ate, broke bread, had a coffee here, actually, in this cafe. You know, I was saying to a group of young people, don't just have your friends on Facebook. Have some people that you disagree with on Facebook. Otherwise, you're just liking each other's stuff and it's going round and round and round and doesn't challenge you to formalise your arguments. I have very fundamental Christians as friends on my Facebook page. Because I want to see what they think. I want to see what they're seeing about safe schools. I want to understand that. Otherwise, you just live a very insular life.
Do you tell the people that you meet about the hate mail that you receive or the cries for help that you receive?
Only when it's useful. I don't want to sound like, my job's hideous. It's not. But when it's useful for people to know that, and I judge that, I tell them.
But when you're travelling in rural areas with Dolly Diamond and whoever else you're with, do kids come up to you and say, this has meant a lot to me?
Oh, yeah. Those experiences are gold. Absolute gold. Because you don't often see in the work that we do, you don't often see your instant impact. But in some of those rural towns, you see an instant impact. And that's priceless. It's absolutely priceless. When you can actually help a family, and I can't pick up every family and deal with every family, but when a particular mother came to me in one town and she was having trouble getting a referral from her GP to the children's hospital for her trans kid, and I was able to ring the hospital and do an intervention, get that person from the hospital to ring the GP and sort it all out. Priceless. When that mum comes up, hugs me and says, you saved my life. It's priceless stuff. Worth every cent, every night away from home, everything, she can come to a training session and say, my son thinks he's a girl, and leave saying, my daughter and I need help. That's stuff that keeps me going. And every time I think I can't get out of bed and do it again, those are the people, those are the interactions, those are the thank you cards, the letters that I get on behalf of government, because I don't think it's me. It's obviously there's a team and there's a whole, authorising environment that I have from this government to do that work. Priceless.
Who inspires you beyond those sorts of interactions?
Those people.
Those people themselves?
Those people, the grassroots people that come to events, that seek me out, that tell me their stories. I am so blessed with the stories that people share with me. So intimate stories about their life, their journey, their struggles. I can feel it in my throat right now talking about it. Those people inspire me to keep going because it makes a difference.
Do you think that equality is inevitable?
No. I think we have to fight, and fight's not the right word. We have to keep, having conversations, keeping people aware of the issues and making sure we challenge people's unconscious biases.
But will your job eventually be a redundant job?
Oh, I would hope so. But I'm sure the Commissioner for Disability and the Commissioner for Aboriginal Affairs hopes the same thing, you know? I don't think I can hang up my bootlaces just yet.
Well, it's been wonderful chatting with you.
My absolute pleasure.
My conversation with Rowena Allen was recorded at the Treasury Cafe, which is one of Ro's favourite haunts. LGBTIQ&A is supported by the Pinnacle Foundation, providing assistance to LGBTIQA plus youth by way of scholarships and mentorships. You can find out more at thepinnaclefoundation.org. Next on LGBTIQ&A.
I think back on it now and I definitely think it could be handled better, and I like to think that if there was another, you know, young person out there in the situation that I was in, that, you know, it would be handled a bit differently.